This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. You can now watch our TV show on Free Speech TV every weekday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern. FSTV is on Dish Network, DirecTV, and Roku. If ever there was a single person who exemplified the term Renaissance man like no other, it was the famous American athlete, singer, actor, lawyer, and civil rights activist Paul Robeson. Even better known outside of the U.S. than inside, Robeson lent his signature baritone voice to myriad struggles abroad, and at home he was a leader in the civil rights movement against Jim Crow racism. In a new book about Robeson, historian Gerald Horn examines the legacy of the multi-talented American within global and domestic struggles against racism, fascism, colonialism, and poverty, and for an internationalist approach to socialism. Gerald Horn is the John Jay and Rebecca Moore's Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. A prolific writer, he has authored more than 30 books and hundreds of papers and articles. His books include Race to Revolution, the U.S. and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States of America, Black Revolutionary William Patterson and the Globalization of the African American Freedom Struggle. He now joins me to discuss his latest book, Paul Robeson, the Artist as Revolutionary. Welcome to the program, Gerald.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, Paul Robeson, I mentioned that he was even better known outside of the U.S. than within. And that's true. Growing up, I heard his name probably more than I heard any other American's name. His songs have been translated into different languages, particularly among sort of leftist, communist-leaning, Marxist struggles and people involved in those struggles. How important is that as an aspect of his legacy, that Paul Robeson, this incredible American revolutionary, was really a globally known figure at a time before the internet?
Well, this is very significant. And I think this is due in part to the fact that Robeson was multilingual. He not only spoke and read most of the major European languages, including English, French, German, Spanish, Russian, etc., but he also studied Hindi. In fact, he used to sing songs in Hindi, a major language of India. He studied African languages. He studied Chinese. In fact, in a well-known incident from the World War II era, the Federal Bureau of Investigation in the United States was able to purloin a notebook featuring Robeson's writings in Chinese script. They thought it was some sort of secret passages he was sending to Mao Zedong and the Chinese revolutionaries, but actually he was working out complicated problems of Chinese grammar. That was what he did in his spare time, study Chinese and study other languages. And I think that because he was able to communicate with audiences overseas, outside the United States in their own tongue, this endeared him quite tremendously to audiences overseas. In fact, there's one incident I talk about in the book where before he was to sing in Norway, just after World War II, he started studying Norwegian perhaps 48 hours before the concert. And by the time of the concert, he was able to communicate it in Norwegian. Now, obviously, this not only bespeaks a scintillating intellect and a very capacious intelligence, but it also bespeaks the fact that Robeson felt that he had an incentive to try to understand the languages of other peoples, because he felt that this was necessary in order to communicate with these people so that they could then lend solidarity to the struggles of his people, speaking of people of African descent in North America.
And so here in the United States, you write in your book that that figures like Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. would not have really been as powerful and influential as they were without Paul Robeson sort of leading the way, laying the groundwork. And I've never really heard that. How exactly did Paul Robeson sort of begin a struggle that then these two now far better known radical and important civil rights leaders took on?
Well, you need to understand that before the era of the so-called civil rights movement, the push against Jim Crow that accelerates in the 1950s, most of your outstanding Black American intellectuals were of the socialist orientation. I'm not only thinking of Paul Robeson, I'm thinking of W.E.B. Du Bois, the founder of Pan-Africanism, the founder of the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. I'm thinking of Shirley Graham Du Bois, better known as his spouse, but actually a socialist intellectual and leader in her own right. I'm thinking of Claudia Jones, who was born in Trinidad and Tobago and migrated to the United States and then was deported from the United States, not least because of her radical activism, and then became a leader of the growing, burgeoning Black British community in London, helping to start the West Indian Carnival there and start the West Indian Gazette, the Black British newspaper. So what happens is that the U.S. ruling elite is very fearful that the Black community is turning to the left, turning towards socialism. And as a result, there is a kind of corrupt bargain that's driven with the centrist leadership. For example, Du Bois was ousted unceremoniously from the NAACP in 1948 on grounds of being sympathetic to the third party candidacy of Henry A. Wallace, whereas the NAACP leaders were supporting the incumbent Harry S. Truman. And as a result of that corrupt bargain, what was involved was that leaders of the socialist left, like Robeson and Du Bois, were marginalized. And in return for that, there were these anti-Jim Crow concessions. For example, the Brown versus Board of Education decision in May 1954, when the High Court of the United States ruled that all of a sudden Jim Crow was unconstitutional, which leads to the era of so-called integration and a kind of desegregation. The price of the ticket paid that allowed for the rise and emergence of Martin Luther King and then subsequently Malcolm X was the marginalizing of these socialist figures like Robeson. In other words, we are all standing on the shoulders of figures like Robeson, and that includes people like Martin Luther King and Malcolm X.
Then in terms of the way in which he sort of harnessed his myriad talents, can you sort of explain how Paul Robeson wasn't an artist separate to an activist? He was both an artist and an activist. How did he express his revolutionary principles through his art? But also, how was he even known just as an artist on his own? You mean Americans appreciated his incredible acting skills and his singing, even if they didn't know about his politics. So in some ways, I suppose he was just this exemplary artist. He was an exemplary activist, but he was also both at the same time, wasn't he?
Absolutely. And I think that he expressed his politics through his art, predominantly through his singing. That is to say, his concerts not only featured folk songs and overtly political songs, they also featured songs in different languages. In other words, Paul Robeson was bringing people's culture to the United States, or if he performed abroad, he was bringing Black American culture to audiences abroad. Secondly, I think it's fair to say that he brought politics into his art through his interpretation of his acting roles, particularly his signature role, which was as Othello in Shakespeare's tragedy. His interpretation of Othello, by his own admission, was a story about a man who did not necessarily fit into the society in which he found himself, but yet he did tremendous service to that society. And in some ways, ironically enough, that particular descriptor helps to capture the essence of Paul Robeson in North America, because as you know, after the onset of the Red Scare and the Cold War in the late 1940s, Paul Robeson became something of a non-person in the United States of America. His income dipped from the six figures to the low four figures. His passport was taken so that he could not travel abroad to make a living. In fact, it took an international movement, including a movement that was manifested in India, that led to Paul Robeson getting his passport back. So this was the essence of Paul Robeson, that is to say, the artist is revolutionary.
Let's talk about his time in India. He, as you write in your book, knew Nehru, the first prime minister of India, elected to India after the fall of the British Empire in 1947. What role did Paul Robeson play in India? How did he learn from India, and what did India get from him?
Well, first of all, you need to know that beginning in the early 1920s, up until the onset of World War II in Europe in 1939, Paul Robeson was more or less a resident of London. And in London, he was in very close touch and very close contact with Indian progressives, Indian revolutionaries, and I should also say Kenyan progressives and Kenyan revolutionaries, such as Jomo Kenyatta, with whom he shared a flat at one time. Also Ghanaian revolutionaries and progressives like Kwame Nkrumah of Ghana. And when Nehru and many other Indian leaders were jailed by the British colonialists as World War II was about to erupt, and as it was erupting, Paul Robeson campaigned and crusaded on their behalf for them to be freed. And then Indian leaders returned the favor after Indian independence by campaigning for him to get his passport. I dare say that India weighed in quite heavily with regard to the international movement to restore Paul Robeson's passport. Recall that India was officially neutral and non-aligned during the Cold War confrontation between Moscow and Washington, and Washington felt that India was a major ideological prize, and so therefore it had to listen when Indian leaders demanded that Paul Robeson's passport be returned.
And so then you mentioned his residence in London. Actually, what even took him, going back for a little bit earlier, what took him to London? And how did he see himself living in London? What was it that London offered him that the United States didn't?
Well, even though London was the capital of a major empire that was enmeshed in white supremacy, I know from my own experience in London, which I've been visiting intermittently, particularly to do research over the past decade or more, that as a Black American, ironically enough, I feel I'm being treated better in London than I am in the United States, where I was born. I think, and this, of course, should not be meant to suggest, for example, that a person of Nigerian ancestry or Jamaican ancestry would say the same thing. I think it has a lot to do with being a U.S. national. That is to say that there had been this kind of contestation between London and Washington going back, of course, to 1776 and the founding of the United States at the War of 1812, where you had the Black population defecting en masse to the British side. And so British elites felt that it was in their interest to try to win over and cultivate Black Americans. The same holds true for France. Recall that Black American intellectuals have been going to France for decades, including Richard Wright, Josephine Baker, James Baldwin, et cetera. And they all testified to the fact that they get treated better in France than they do in the United States, although the same would not necessarily hold true for a Senegalese or a Martinican or someone from one of France's colonies. So I think that context helps to explain why Paul Robeson became an exile, an expatriate in London, because in many ways he was treated better. When he did Othello in London, for example, there are these scenes with Desdemona, who of course is the woman of European ancestry to whom he is attracted, shall we say. And Robeson oftentimes suggested in the 1930s when he was acting Othello in London that if he had been holding Desdemona as Othello passionately in New York, there might have been people who would rush the stage, wanted to lynch him, for example, because it was considered a tremendous faux pas for a man of African ancestry to hug passionately a woman of European descent, either on the stage or off the stage. So I think that that helps to explain and shed light on the fact why Robeson spent so much time in London. In fact, I dare say that if World War II had not erupted in Europe in August 1939, he might have spent his rest of his life in London. But of course, with the guns of war sounding, he thought that the better part of wisdom was to depart with his spouse and his mother-in-law and his young son. But of course, there hangs a tale, because coming back to the United States marked the beginning of Robeson's Waterloo.
Right. So let's talk about what Robeson was subjected to in the United States. You referred earlier to how most of the sort of global leaders of that era were openly socialist, leaned towards socialism. And you have this great quote in your book, which I just love. If Stalin discredited socialism for all time, why didn't the African slave trade discredit capitalism for all time? And that just really, I think, points to the attraction that socialism held, particularly for African Americans. How socialist openly was Paul Robeson, and how did that become the sort of linchpin of his, the reason why he sort of became resigned into obscurity, lost the salary and the money that he was making, and lost a lot of credibility among Americans?
Well, Robeson read Marx and Engels in German. He read Lenin in Russian. Of course, he spoke both languages. But I think in order to understand why Robeson moved so decisively to the left, you have to understand his close friend and comrade, William Paterson, who also wrote a book about, also a black lawyer. Paul Robeson matriculated at Columbia University Law School, William Paterson at the University of California. They were friends in Harlem before Robeson migrated to London in the early 1920s. And it was in the early 1930s that Robeson visited Germany, when it was already in the snare of fascism and the rule of the Nazi Party. He had some very unpleasant encounters there, and that helped to convert him into being a lifelong anti-fascist. As a matter of fact, he oftentimes defined himself as an anti-fascist. But it was his conversations with William Paterson, a man who led the campaign to free the Scottsboro Nine. These are the nine black youth who were arrested and about to be executed on false allegations of sexual molestation of two Euro-American women. It became an international campaign that Paterson led. And it was his conversations with Paterson who convinced him that he should devote more of his time and energy, and his bank account too, by the way, to campaigning on behalf of the victims of Jim Crow, that led Robeson to do a more intensive study that led him to become a lifelong socialist. I should also say that, like many black Americans, and I would say that this includes myself, that many black Americans moved to the left, not least because, of course, the atrocious conditions one encounters in North America, but also because of the inspiration and the example of African leaders who were overwhelmingly and disproportionately of the socialist orientation. And that certainly holds true for Robeson himself. That is to say, in London, he was influenced by these African students and African revolutionaries then in exile in that capital of the British Empire.
And so what about his brush with HUAC, the House Un-American Activities Committee here in the U.S.? Tell us that story.
Well, more than once, particularly after the Red Scare, the Cold War deepened, Paul Robeson was hauled before the House Un-American Activities Committee. This was a congressional committee that was persistently and consistently trying to root out what it considered to be a so-called communist threat. And Robeson, being a figure of world renown and a man of the socialist path, was a frequent target of HUAC. He had numerous confrontations with HUAC over the years. And the same holds true for Paterson as well. As a matter of fact, in my biography of Paterson, I talk about how a Georgia congressman was about to physically assault Paterson in a hearing room on Capitol Hill.
Wow.
Now, no such incident ever befell Robeson, perhaps because he was a tad more diplomatic than his comrade Paterson. But this was emblematic of the times. This was emblematic of the 1950s. This was emblematic of a time of hysteria when Washington felt that it had to roll back what it considered to be the so-called communist threat, which of course led it to debacles and quagmires on the Korean Peninsula, Vietnam, and elsewhere.
How did Paul Robeson put his money where his mouth was? How did he fund and help financially help boost organizations that were doing really important work? And some of those connections, of course, would later come to haunt him.
Well, Exhibit A in that regard would be the Council on African Affairs, which came into existence in the late 1930s and was the major political vehicle for Robeson's bankroll and also for his activism. For the longest time, he served as chairperson of the Council on African Affairs. Its mandate was to campaign against European colonialism in Africa. It had a special relationship with the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa. In fact, in the early pages of this book, I tell the story of a march in South Africa in 1952, featuring Nelson Mandela's African National Congress. This is on the 300th anniversary of the arrival of Europeans at the southern tip of Africa in 1652. And the marchers of Mandela's ANC were marching to the tune of Paul Robeson's singing South African freedom songs. But he also campaigned for numerous causes, including the intervention by the French in Vietnam in the 1950s in particular. He campaigned on behalf of those who were victimized by the U.S. intervention in Guatemala during that same time. And of course, he was very close to leaders of the U.S. Communist Party, including Ben Davis Jr., who was also a black lawyer, a graduate of Harvard Law School, elected to New York City Council in 1943, reelected in New York, to the Senate City Council in 45 before unceremoniously ousted, perhaps illegally, and then indicted and then jailed. Robeson raised money for his cause. And of course, Ben Davis's lawyer was George Crockett, a black lawyer from Detroit, who went on to become a leader of the Congressional Black Caucus, representing a mostly black district in the city of Detroit. And Robeson also raised money for George Crockett. So he put his money where his mouth is.
So how openly socialist was Paul Robeson? Did he ever talk about his socialist views? Did he ever, how did he lay out his vision? Not just here in the, for his vision for the United States, but globally. As you mentioned, he was a Pan-Africanist. He lived he visited so many different countries, had so many ties to so many international leaders. Did he have a vision for international socialism that he openly espoused?
Yes, he did. I would say, however, that Paul Robeson was not much of a writer. This is what correspondents complained about all the time. He did pen.
So, of all his amazing talents, that was the one arena in which he didn't excel.
Right. He did write this memoir, Here I Stand, which sets forth his socialist vision. It's still in print, by the way, and I quote from it quite a bit. Paul Robeson has been attacked in the United States because of his association with the now defunct Soviet Union and the way it styled the socialist path. But keep in mind that in 1941, the United States was facing antagonists in Berlin and in Tokyo and in Rome, and it had no hesitation, no compunction in aligning with Moscow at that particular moment. In fact, in a previous book, I talked about how then-President Franklin Delano Roosevelt leaned on Hollywood to produce pro-Soviet movies, which it did, including Mission to Moscow, which you might be able to find on YouTube, which presents a shocking, from today's vantage point, view of what the Soviet Union was all about. In other words, it was very glowing. What I'm trying to suggest is that facing Jim Crow terror and the justice of the rope of the lyncher, Black American leaders of the socialist path, such as Paul Robeson, felt that they had to make alliances with Moscow, just like the United States had to make alliances with Moscow. With regard to his socialist vision, I think it would involve the empowerment of the working class, particularly through unions. He was very close to the National Maritime Union, which was led by a Jamaican immigrant by the name of Ferdinand Smith. I wrote a book about Ferdinand Smith, you might recall. He was very close to the West Coast Longshoremen, the International Longshore and Warehousemen's Union, headed by the Australian migrant Harry Bridges, headquartered in San Francisco. So I would say that working class empowerment and public control of the commanding heights of the economy would be at the crux of Paul Robeson's vision for socialism.
So then finally, Gerald, what happened to Paul Robeson? When he died, it was 1976, I believe. It was really sort of a shadow of the peaks that he had reached both internationally and here in the US, in his prime. How did he end up in as much obscurity as he did?
Well, part of it has to do with the repeated and repetitive attacks on him by the US ruling class. I mean, you can get to hot water in the 1950s and the 1960s if you seem to be sympathetic to Paul Robeson. But of course, that does not stop Martin Luther King Jr., nor Malcolm X for that matter, from being in solidarity with Paul Robeson during those two gentlemen's heyday. I should also say that Paul Robeson suffered health reversals beginning in the 1950s. And this led, after his wife passed away in the 1960s, to his returning to the United States. Because recall that after he got his passport in 1958, he left immediately and returned to London, which he always felt was the place he felt most comfortable. But then after his wife passed away, he had to come back to the United States because of declining health, moved in with his sister in Philadelphia, and that's where he died. And after he moved in with his sister, he became something of a recluse. Now, he still studied languages, he still studied music, but he became much less of a public figure. But that did not restrain, say, the Congressional Black Caucus and King and Coretta Scott King and others from saluting him at every opportunity.
Well, I appreciate your salute to him in your new book about Paul Robeson. Gerald Horn, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
My guest is Gerald Horn, the John J. and Rebecca Moore's Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston, a prolific writer. He's authored more than 30 books and hundreds of papers and articles. We've been discussing his latest book, Paul Robeson, The Artist as Revolutionary. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com and on Facebook at facebook.com/ruwithsonali.